Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, federalism and the resistance. And Richard, I framed this conversation this way because one of the ironies of the Trump administration has been the extent to which it has created an enthusiasm for federalism amongst liberals who would generally have more centralizing instincts. And we see this most vividly in attempts by a number of states to bypass the administration and go their own way on policy. Right now, there is a fight of this type going on over the issue of fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. California, because it already had its own air quality regulations going back before the Federal Clean Air Act, was allowed to sort of keep its own regime when that law was enacted. And now there are about a dozen other states that abide by the California standards. And now we have a situation where the Trump administration wants to freeze the fuel efficiency standards that the Obama administration had planned. And it wants to take away California's ability to set their own standards over and above those. So we can get to the policy there in a minute, but why don't we start with the law? If there is a showdown between the feds and California here, who has the better chance of prevailing in court?
Well, it depends on what does at the federal level. I'm not a true expert on all of the intricacies on this, but I believe that the waiver in question is one which is given as a waiver, not as something that's built into the statute. So you take it two ways. To the extent that this thing is built into a statute, it's going to take another statute to overcome it. To the extent that it's a waiver which is built in as a matter of policy on which everybody has relied for a long time, you could usually remove a waiver by perhaps giving a hearing. Even that's not clear, but you'd surely want to do one. And then you could reverse it. What California is then going to have to do is to come into court and say that there's some prescription or long-term precedent, which means that you can't alter this without its consent. And my guess is, to the extent that this thing is a waiver rather than a statutory protection, they will lose on that particular issue. But make no mistake about it, this is not just a legal question. The forces are already lined up on this thing, and California is coming out guns blazing. It will hire the best lawyers in town that it can find because it wants to do this. Now, my own view on the issue is I never believed in the waiver in the first place. And the explanation is kind of complicated, but it goes to the fact that when you're dealing with these issues, can you sell cars into a national market where they move about from state to state with great rapidity under standards that are multiple standards? Can't do that. It's going to be one standard and no standard. So that what happens is, in the California situation, if it gets the waiver and it does this, it sets the de facto standard for the rest of the United States, because several states will follow it, as they're now allowed to do under the scheme. And if they decide to follow it, there's no manufacturer that can ignore the size of the California market. It has 50 million people in California. It's about a sixth of the population, has more than a sixth of the cars. New York follows along with this. By the time you're done, you have to build one and only one car. And that's the car that meets the particular standards that California puts out. So that is, I think, an essential problem. Now, how serious are the various issues here? Well, if you're trying to talk about pollution, it makes perfectly good sense, I think, for somebody to say, all right, there's a lot of smog in California. There are a lot of point sources in California that can do this. What you ought to do is to have some more stringent control inside the Los Angeles basin, because there's a lot more harm. But you mentioned this is a fuel efficiency measure. And there is absolutely very weak, if probably no, maybe even negative correlation between the miles that you put on a car and the amount of emissions that go out. And let me explain why this is the case. What happens is, as cars get older, the rate of decay in their systems get much larger, and the amount of emissions per mile goes way the world up, whether or not you get your checks on your catalytic converters and so forth. At the very best, a 2010 car could be no better today than it was in 2010. The modern cars, even if you don't change the standards, will be much better. So when you raise the CAFE standards, what you do is you raise the cost of the cars in question, which means that you lower the rate of replacement of automobiles so that the age of the fleet on the road is going to get older. And when that happens, you're going to get more pollution from the older cars, and you're going to get fewer substitutions of new cars. So it's not at all clear, and it's probably going to work out the other way, that by importing impossibly high standards on new cars, you're going to increase the amount of pollution, not only of carbon dioxide, which I think is much overrated as a risk, but for all the really undisputably nasty stuff, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, and all the rest of it. So you're not even sure that these guys are moving in the right direction with respect to this. There are also other features of design that are extremely awkward. Why do you want to do this stuff on a fleet basis instead of doing it on a car basis? If you do it on a car basis, what you do is you don't have these crazy cross subsidies that come along, where in order to make a big car, which people want to buy, you now have to make a little car. That means that all automobile companies have to be full-line companies, whereas there's enormous production gains from specialization. So if what you say, in effect, is we want to make sure that cars that are bigger pay a heavier load. If you put a tax on the car or a tax on gasoline, then you don't have to worry about these cross-subsidizations within fleets. When this was done originally, the thought was that the Japanese were going to come in and they would take advantage of this. And if we started to put in this thing, then the Japanese, who we thought were going to enter first with luxury cars, would be differentially disadvantaged. Obviously, all that politics has changed many, many years. So the complete design of the CAFE program is totally flawed. Sam Katzman, who works at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, has been hawking the China on this thing for 35 years, and I think he's basically right. So I think you want to get rid of these kinds of things, and then you want to concentrate on the pollution that matters. And for the most part, that is not going to be carbon dioxide. It's going to be the other gases that I referred to.
Let me ask you about another area where progressives are employing federalism as a way to try to thwart the Trump administration. The most obvious other one that comes to mind is immigration and the existence of sanctuary cities. And again, in the case of California, a sanctuary state, where they just say they simply will not cooperate with federal authorities in turning over illegal immigrants. The Trump administration has threatened to strip federal funding from these jurisdictions. But last week, you had a Ninth Circuit ruling saying that that was unconstitutional. Richard, slightly different dynamic here in that we're talking about an issue with immigration where we know that the federal government bears primary responsibility. What do you make of the Ninth Circuit's ruling?
Well, I mean, the Ninth Circuit has a tremendous rate of reversal when it gets up to the United States Supreme Court. And it seems to me that, generally speaking, the federal government would have a right to withdraw the grants unless there's some statutory reason which says that they somehow or other have to keep them going. And so at this point, there is this very complicated dynamic of exactly what is it that the federal government could demand of the states. And there are these anti-commandeering decisions that are out there, which says that you cannot require states to cooperate with you in the execution and the enforcement of federal law. And then the question would be exactly how does that apply? Does it mean that somebody in California can release a prisoner who's known to be dangerous without telling the federal government? Or does it mean that they have to tell the federal government about it and give them a chance to intervene, but they don't have to do anything other than hold the person long enough so that that transition could be made? I would be inclined to say that they probably have to do at least that much. They cannot actively frustrate the operation of the federal system by making releases that makes it extremely hard for people to get it. And this is known as the frustration head of preemption. There are three heads. There's one called occupying the field, one called direct conflict, and one called frustration. So I think, in effect, that the state's on very weak grounds in this particular situation if the federal government wants to do it. What the federal government cannot do is if there are people in the field whom they would like to arrest, they can't deputize this to an unwilling State Department and said, your police department now has to go out and bring these people to us at your expense. But I don't think we're very close to that. And, you know, as you said, this is a tremendous reversal. If you go back and read some of the earlier cases on the 10th Amendment and reserve powers, the most famous of these is a case called United States against Darby from 1941. It turns out the 10th Amendment is just a truism. Federal government can do anything it wants, and so there are no independent state rights which say that, for example, the states can resist the imposition of a minimum wage law on local manufacturing activities. Everything is covered by the federal government. And I regarded that decision as just horrendously wrong at the time that it came down, and I continue to do so. I don't tend to switch positions on these issues. My view about this is that the structural stuff has to be pretty constant, regardless of who's in power at which level. And you cannot have a coherent theory of federalism, which when the Democrats are in power at the central government means that they can boss everybody around. And when the Democrats are out of power, but they control the states, then they can negate the federal government. So on the federalism question, I think that the Democrats are wrong. Whether or not Trump has done the right thing in terms of policy, generally speaking, he's always ham-handed on how he does these things. Is there a way in which you could gain state cooperation on some issues and agree to disagree on others? My guess is that you probably could work out a deal, but you can't work out that deal so long as Jeff Sessions is the Attorney General of the United States, because he's simply a hardline enforcer. But I would have thought that even the Democrats would be prepared to say that people who are arrested not for immigration violations, but for violent crimes, murder, rape, property theft, and so forth, those people, in effect, would either be deported or be turned over to the federal government to be put into jail. So I'm very frustrated by this entire debate. I think it's a terrible mistake to say, well, we hate Donald Trump, and so therefore we will block everything that he tries to do, whether or not the law is on your side. And I think California probably has the weaker position with respect to the waiver and the weaker position with respect to immigration.
Let me turn you now to some of the sort of theory of federalism. Richard, when conservatives talk about federalism, they often talk about empowering state and local governments. But the text of the 10th Amendment, which is usually the lodestar of federalism aficionados, reads, I'm quoting here, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people," close quote. So no mention of local governments there. And indeed, in a lot of states, you've got state governments that try to preempt and rein in things that are being done by local governments. So explain for us how local governments fit in the federalism ecosystem.
Well, the way in which you have to understand it is that the federalism question treats the state as the entity, and then the state has more or less complete power over the way in which it wishes to divide the power that it has to the central government, to the counties, to the municipalities, and so forth. So if it turns out that a state like California wants to say, look, Palo Alto, you want a high minimum wage law, higher than the state because you've got a very prosperous community, they can put that thing into place, and indeed they have. So if you have delegated authority from your state government, you as a local government or a county government can do more or less what you want. But of course, counties are not the same thing as states in the United States. California or any other state could reshuffle the deck, get rid of its county boundaries tomorrow and put together a new system in place, and it would not offend the federal constitution, though it might in some ways the state constitution. Whereas if you tried to get rid of the states at the federal constitutional level, or try to get rid of the rule which gives every state two senators, you can't do that under the Constitution. It's World War III. That's one of the two clauses that were essentially fully entrenched against modification, the other having to do with the importation of slaves whose validity expired in 1808. So it was a 20-year window on that. They're completely different on their internal operations. In terms of what happens at the federal constitutional level, the Equal Protection Clause says that no state shall deny any individual the equal protection of the laws. And that's been read wrongly, I think, as a textual matter to apply to the ways in which states do voting stuff. And so now the federal government, for example, can come in and tell a state, no, you cannot apportion votes in the counties as if they were states in the federal government, one vote per county. You have to always do it on population basis and so forth. And so essentially, the local governments are simply an extra in the story. It's a federal and state kind of conflict. And before the Commerce Clause was expanded to its current levels, it was widely understood that there were many activities that the federal government could not touch. And so state autonomy was guaranteed constitutionally. And the traditional triad on that was manufacturing, agriculture, and mining, which is, of course, a very large chunk of many economies. And in most of the versions on the pre-1937 all local transportation, the cab you take from your home to the airport, would also be beyond federal control. Now that all of this stuff is subject to federal regulation, the preemption issues and the federalisms get much, much bigger than they've otherwise had been. And of course, when progressives are in power at the center, they really want to push that preemption for all that it's worth. But now that they're not in power, what they've done is they've switched stories. I think the correct solution is to go back to the pre-1937 constitutional design. That's extremely difficult to do. There's no willingness to do it. So I think what we have to do is to stick with the standard doctrines that were developed, not accidentally or coincidentally, in 1946 in a case called Rice against the Santa Fe Railroad, where these three heads of preemption were done. That's a relatively stable body of law. At least it was until this thing became entirely politicized. And it isn't perfect, but it is a neutral kind of lodestone which you should apply regardless of whether the Democrats or the Republicans are in control at the federal or at the state level.
The final question that I ask you, I guess, is really more one of political philosophy. The relative role of the states was a major flashpoint during the founding generation. And you can actually see a broad cross-section of the debate in one man, James Madison, who at the Constitutional Convention proposed a federal negative under which the federal government could veto state laws, and then within a dozen years was co-authoring with Thomas Jefferson the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, which would have given states the power to declare federal laws unconstitutional. Now, you've explained for us already the ways in which the status quo here has morphed over the years. But if we go back to the start, did the founders, in your judgment, strike the right balance on federalism at the inception of the country?
I think they did a pretty good job, considering how little they had to go on. Their basic intuition was as follows. If you're dealing with an industry which is long and skinny, communication or transportation being the two, there's a great danger that any given state could snip the entire transportation system by refusing to allow people to go back and forth across its borders. And so the federal government, when it had the power to regulate commerce amongst the several states, it was designed to make sure that the arteries of commerce would be left open and that essentially you could have a national goods for markets. But when it came to the production of these particular goods in mining and agriculture, they saw no particular advantage in having this done by the federal regulation. And I think there were two things that they thought of. One is they thought that the principle of subsidiarity seemed to work, which meant that local conditions and local knowledge would allow you to do a better job in regulating these things at the ground than trying to do it at a distance from the federal government. And that was essentially the point that Madison made in Federalist 10 when he talked about, you know, the advantages and disadvantages of the extended republic. And he was on both sides of that question, as everybody else turns out to be. And then there's also the other danger, which is if you allow for federal regulation, you're not going to promote competition by removing state barriers to communication and transportation, you're going to cartelize the whole business. And in fact, when the 1935 to 1942 revolution started to take place, cartelization was at its heart. Jones and Laughlin in 1937 meant that when you were dealing with labor unions, you could now organize them at the state level, and that's the creation of monopoly powers and duties for collective bargaining. And on the other hand, when Wickett and Filburn comes down in 1942, that allows you to cartelize the entire agricultural industry by putting quotas that are done first by state, then by county, and then by farm, so as to restrict the output of wheat and corn in ways that get you up to monopoly levels. And so these guys were very worried about all that. And so they got that part right. Now, what did they get wrong? Well, interestingly enough, what they got wrong was the question of how much can you trust the states with respect to local activities. And so from the very beginning, there were real questions about whether or not there should be federal protection against state confiscation of local goods and services and properties. The Dartmouth College case involved a situation in which the state of New Hampshire wanted to revoke Dartmouth College private charter so that it could make it into a state school, ruin it, I suppose. And Daniel Webster comes up and argues, and this is a small school, but those who attended it love it. And Justice Marshall, the Chief Justice, essentially says, nope, the contracts clause applies to this. So all the time prior to 1865, what happened is all of the efforts to constrain what states can do in ways that were thought to be arbitrary and capricious, went through the contracts clause. No state shall impair the obligation of contract. And this is very question, difficult questions as to what it meant. The moment you get to 1865, and you're thinking about this after secession and civil war, the view comes along that, you know, what we really have to do is we don't want the states making, federal government making laws for the states. God forbid we should ever want to have a congressional veto in the sense that Madison had talked about. But we do want to have a federal government and a judicial system which has the power to strike down state laws by giving us protection. So the 14th Amendment is organized in two parts, at least the beginning, first part. One of them is the Citizenship Clause. Lord knows that's a huge controversy. But the one undeniable thing that it meant to do and did do was to make sure that all black slaves were citizens of the United States if they were born here. And anybody else who was naturalized here became a citizen as well. And then the rest of it puts limitations on what states can do to people who are citizens of the United States and citizens of their respective states. Privileges and immunities essentially is a very high level of protection given only to citizens. And what it's designed to do is to make sure that the states cannot suppress economic liberties or confiscate property, all right, stop people from engaging in certain kinds of occupation. It was largely gutted in the slaughterhouse cases, which came down within 10 years after it started, 1873 or so. So that didn't last very much. Then there were the due process and the equal protection guarantees. Those did not apply only to citizens. They applied to all persons, including aliens. And they were designed to make sure that there was the equal enforcement of the criminal law. You couldn't chase after foreigners and put them in jail arbitrarily, and that you couldn't seize property or throw people in jail under incarceration under the Due Process Clause. And so the great flaw of the Madisonian design was that they did not put federal protections against state abuses of their own citizens or of the citizens of the other state. But the other two parts of it, I think that they basically got it right. And ironically, if you're worried about keeping market competition alive, if you make sure that the arteries of competition are stepped over, then a limited view of the Commerce Clause, so it doesn't allow you to get local production into it, really makes a lot of sense, because then you have a national market with very easy transportation and you get yourself a highly competitive system. And that was certainly what they envisioned, because if you look at the import-export clause amongst various states, they're very suspicious about this power. They do allow you to do this to inspect for safety and health, and they do you allow you to collect money. But there's this odd provision which tells you how much they feared the states, which if you collect money and their excesses above and beyond that, which is then for protection, you got to remit the rest to the federal government. Can't keep it. Can't use this as an extraction device. Donald Trump should take note on this particular problem. And we also had a rule in which you could not impose export barriers, although we could impose import barriers. And, you know, they should have basically put the barrier, the prohibition on both. We'd have saved ourselves a lot of problems. But I think, in effect, what Madison does, he gets himself a solid A minus, right? Doesn't get it right. But compared to what people knew at the time, this is such a remarkable advance of everything that had happened before that it's an astonishing human achievement. Notwithstanding the fact, literally from the time that the ink was dried on the document, in a whole variety of ways, the Electoral College, Supreme Court jurisdiction, and so forth, the guys who drafted it in 1787, by the time you get to 1791 or 1790, they say, oh my God, did we really do this? That's how easy it is to make mistakes.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sennett. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.